the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Medina, and we have Mark Roderman, host of Front Row on UNC TV. So we're going to talk a lot of North Carolina politics. We'll kick it off and get started. And we're just really excited about the show today and to have his insights and really, I think, discuss kind of where this state is headed, especially the direction of the Republican Party and just sort of politics in general. So Brooke, Mark, how y'all doing today?
Great.
Yeah, we're glad to have you here today, Mark. Thank you so much. And so we wanted to kick this off. Let's talk a little bit of politics first, and then let's get a little more philosophical. Okay? Does that sound good?
Great.
Okay. So first, we know that we've got a big Senate race here in the state of North Carolina, and it's in the primary season right now. Senator Tillis is up for re-election in 2020. And so it was recently revealed that half of his campaign war chest is being devoted to primary expenditures.
Television buy.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about who he's running up against at the moment?
He's running against Garland Tucker, who's a businessman, very successful, who's been up on TV now for about 4.5 months. I would say that when I was involved, and I'm a recovering consultant, that when I used to do TV and we used to do campaigns, we never let a charge go unanswered. 4 months. I think Garland's had a free field to run in here down the field without anybody trying to tackle him for 4 months. And I think that's given him a leg up. And I mean, the last poll I saw was 37, I think 31, a public policy poll. And for an incumbent to be at that stage, if he's not close to 50, being Tom Tillis, I'd say he's in some trouble.
Yeah, let me ask you something, just sort of get your insights on that race. A lot of us in the Triangle know Garland Tucker real well. He may not have that statewide recognition, at least in his name, that maybe another candidate would. Do you think that Tillis would be even in more trouble if someone like Mark Walker or even Meadows had decided to run, or is he just in trouble?
No, I don't think that's it. I don't think it's about Garland. I think it's about Tom Tillis. And Carter Wrenn is running that race, so they're making it about Tom Tillis. They're making it about the article he wrote about not supporting the president on a national emergency in the Washington Post and then flipping. So now let's be clear. I would still say that Tillis has the upper hand. And the reason I say that is because he's the incumbent, one. And two, he has a great deal ability to raise a ton of money out of D.C. He's got the Chamber of Commerce behind him. He's got the National Senatorial, Republican Senatorial Committee behind him. So that's a lot of folks with a lot of money behind him. They'll probably come in. He has Mitch McConnell's pack behind him. Mm-hmm. They'll probably come in here shortly and probably spend as much money. But the question is, as we know with Trump, particularly Jeb Bush, money doesn't always buy you love in campaigns. Because Jeb Bush spent a ton in the primary. And what did he come in, fifth or sixth?
Yeah. Yeah, and I just pulled this up. Just kind of, you can see the evolution of Tom Tillis's change here. 94% conservative rating from Heritage Action Score. That's his Heritage Action Score for this session. But lifetime is 67%. So he's certainly moved to the right. I mean, this is obvious. A lot of candidates do that. But he's certainly moved to the right in this primary season. So it'll be interesting to see how the impact of Trump's support and just sort of his overall move to the right in commercials and campaign kind of evolves with his sort of sinking popularity.
This is awful early for the president to endorse him.
Yeah.
So that tells you that he's in trouble. Because it'd be a natural for the president to endorse him. He's a sitting senator. But he's doing this in September of 19. Think about that.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. He's probably the incumbent that's in the most trouble, at least on the Republican side, going into 2020.
Well, I'd say Cory Gardner out of Colorado is in trouble, too.
So what? Just take us back a little bit. What has put him in this position? It's not exclusively, I would say, that Washington Post op-ed. I think that there are other things in his history that may have also lent to that.
Voting to increase spending. I think it's his whole policy on immigration, DACA, But more importantly, I don't think the base of the Republican Party, that which is now the Trump Party, I mean, 83% or more, you guys do the poll.
Mm-hmm.
So you can challenge me on that. But the last poll I saw was like 83% mm-hmm. of the Republican Party here support Donald Trump. He's not in line with the Trump Party on a lot of things. And I think he's more of a Chamber of Commerce, Charlotte-type candidate. Now, remember, when he ran back in 14, he had a lot of help. I mean, the Koch, mm-hmm. okay, at the Freedom Institute spent, Freedom Partners Institute spent $20 million
right.
in support of him. And that really helped him keep him in the game. And those issues were Medicare, Obamacare, and those sort of things. And he ran with that. And I think a lot of people thought he was more conservative than he is. But North Carolina in the Republican Party is still very conservative.
Right. Mm-hmm. Good point.
So do you foresee him receiving that level of support this go around as well? Obviously, Trump has endorsed him, but let's talk about some of those PACs. I know AFP has come out in support of him, so Americans for Prosperity, which is a Koch-funded network. But any other support?
Well, I'd say the Chamber of Commerce, I'd say Mitch McConnell's PAC. I'd say some other PACs up in Washington. The National Republican Senatorial Committee will come in. But they look at numbers like everybody else.
Yep.
So they'll make decisions probably. They'll see if numbers move. They'll be probably tracking the advertising now for the next 2 weeks to see if any numbers are moving on there. But I would say in January, February, if they see that he's not going to win, that support will shrink mm-hmm. dramatically.
Yeah.
They'll start picking other races they want to be involved with.
That's a good point, because I think I remember reading just a few months back that Club for Growth was kind of on the sidelines and thinking about making a decision. Obviously, they spent a lot of money for Dan Bishop and are involved in campaigns all over the country, but they kind of were looking at this race and they thought, hey, we need more of a conservative candidate to retain this seat in North Carolina.
Well, they're looking for more of a business candidate. And frankly, Garland Tucker fits mm-hmm. that profile better for the Club for Growth than I say Tom Tillis. I mean, right. He has more experience. He's created multiple companies. He's done very well in his lifetime, and he's putting a tremendous amount of his own money in. Will he get more money from folks across the state like we were talking about off camera? We'll see.
Right.
Okay. So very interesting race to watch. Are there any other races outside of North Carolina that you're particularly interested in?
Well, I think you've got to watch the race in Colorado with Cory Gardner. I think he's the most vulnerable Republican. What I think is happening now, if you look at it, is that Trump is winning. And I'm not, look, I had an opportunity to work for Trump back in 2016, did not sign on with him because I just started my show. But he's winning on the border. He's winning with the economy. When people see their 401ks and they're doing well, they're happy. We have the lowest unemployment for Black African Americans that we've had, I think, in recorded history. Hispanic Americans are doing real well. There's more people. We don't have enough people to fill the jobs that people want to create right now. So I'd say that Trump is winning right now. And the other thing is, look at the presidential race. And we're truly a purple state right
mm-hmm.
now. Okay. I don't see Biden getting up to Iowa. I don't think really? He'll ever make it past the first of the year. I think his gaffes, he misremembers too much.
Yeah.
He makes too many wild kind of statements. Just not in track. And the person who's very on fire right now is Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'd have to say without bias that she's running on a socialistic program,
mm-hmm.
period, in a story. Medicare for all, free
reparations, free college tuition.
Free college, yeah. Yeah.
Or tuition repayment, yeah. Yep.
So where's the money going to come from? And who's going to pay for that?
Mm-hmm.
And, the wealthy can't pay for all this. So it's going to come down to the middle class are going to be taxed. And I just don't think that's going to work. And if there's a new survey out by the Kaiser, we're going to talk about this this week on Front Row. Kaiser Permanente took a poll. Even Democrats now are in the Rust Belt states are saying, look, Medicare for all sounds great, but we want Obama. Care, we want that kind of fixed. We want the public option. We want our private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Medicare for all would get rid of private insurance. So I think the issues are lining up for Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that's key right now. Plus, if you look at what Trump's doing, I mean, if you look at the people on stage right now, who are on stage on the Democratic Party, he's almost outraised in total.
Yeah, he's raised a ton of money.
More money than
all of them combined.
Yeah.
Combined.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got a good operation. They have a good digital operation. And, but I would say that Elizabeth Warren, to me, would give the president more of a run for his money than Biden or any other. And the one that's really failed is one Beto O'Rourke, but now in fifth place in California is Senator Kamala Harris. She's in fifth place
in California.
Behind Andrew Yang.
Yeah,
yes.
That Yang. Says something.
Let me ask you something real quick, Mark, because I'm interested in, there's a lot of polls. You know, we talked about Trump is obviously going to run a big, expensive campaign. It's going to be big, go big or go home. But a lot of polls, the media focus.
It's gonna be huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
The polls focus, I mean, the media focuses a lot of time on these polls, and North Carolina is kind of a counterexample. And I think that's why, Ron McDaniel shared our polls and stuff because all the media focuses on all the swing states that the Democrat challengers are leading Trump in these polls. Is that just obviously it's so early and so you can't take too much from polling. And I do agree that Warren is setting up herself to be, you know, one of the strongest challengers. But do you think that these polls are just sort of because there's focus on the Democrats? Is it a little bit of an anomaly? What's going on with
right, because they don't have a candidate yet.
Yeah.
Once they have a candidate and it's a contrast with Trump and say Warren, I think the race dramatically shifts, okay, because the issue shifts are going to be dramatic. We're talking about free enterprise versus socialism. And I don't think this country's at the stage where they're going to buy into socialism. I think that's a huge issue this time. The other issue that's going to be huge is when you've got now, this is coming up in the debate this week. There's two really key things are coming up in Congress. One is the USMCA, okay, which is the biggest trade deal we've ever done, all right? It will really help North Carolina farmers. The Democrats, if you put it on the floor, will vote for it now. But will Nancy Pelosi give Donald Trump that win? Really, it's a win for America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It would help us in trade negotiations with China. But the real issue is, I think it's going to come up, it's going to be a real issue of contrast is, look, Trump has, I don't know if you saw this, but he's going to have some sort of universal background. All right, but that was leaked from the Justice Department.
Right.
How it got leaked. Okay. But you have Beto O'Rourke and people saying we're going to confiscate your
car. Yeah, he blew up in.
That's an ad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an ad. Yep. Rust Belt, that's an ad.
There's no doubt about it.
And so I think they're hurting their own cause. People want something done on guns, but particularly women. And I saw in this poll, Kaiser Permanente, it took 54% of Republican women want to get rid of assault weapons.
Mm-hmm.
So, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's the
right.
A nebulous definition.
Right, but
yeah.
they relate to that.
Right.
So, suburban women want something done. And by the way, okay, we're talking about Dan Bishop's race. And that was a 12-point Trump district.
Sure.
By 2 points.
Right.
That's a cautionary tale for Republicans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I still think Republicans problems with
suburban women
persist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. And actually, let's just camp on this a little bit more at the national political level. So I was reading an article the other day in National Review, and it was talking about Republicans retiring. So why do you think so many Republicans in Congress are deciding to retire in this new age, new political landscape?
I mean, candidly, it's no fun to be in the minority.
Democrats said the same thing.
And the 9 yards of it is there's not that collegiality that they had back in the 60s or the 50s. And when the guys came back from World War II, I didn't know this till today, but I was in an article in Newsmax, that congressmen or women, they only had 2 paid trips back to their district up until the late 60s. So it forced them to be with folks on the weekends of different parties, and they were friends, they babysit, you know, Cokie Robertson just passed away. She would babysit Republicans and their father, you know, children, mm-hmm. and and they worked together. But my point about the Greatest Generation is they came back and they wanted to move this country forward. Now, they had philosophical difference, but they would compromise. Mm-hmm. And once the day was over and it was quitting time, they'd go out and have a drink or dinner. That doesn't happen anymore. Things are so polarized. Everybody's in their own corners, and I think that's bad for America.
Mm-hmm. I tend to agree with you. I think that there's a lot to be said about trying to just build some bridges again and treat people like people, right?
Well, I think, so. You know, I don't know about all the tweets and everything. I saw Rand Paul the other day was in a discussion with, I forget, a senator and a Democratic senator, and they're going back and forth with each other. To me, it was childish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, pick up the phone, and if you got a beef or you have a problem, call them and talk it out.
Right.
And I think things need to move forward, and I think there's constant one side or the other is self-segregating, whether we're doing it with the media or not, because you have CNN, you have MSNBC, and then you have Fox. What the people on CNN, they're watching CNN,
yeah,
and MSNBC are not watching Fox, and vice versa. So you're only really getting one side of the story from those folks. I think civil discussion works. That's what we try to do on Front Row. And believe me, all my panelists, as you know, because you've been on Brooke, I don't always agree with them, but I'm going to give them a shot to say what they believe. I think that's fair access.
Yeah. And that's much appreciated. I think that helps other people realize that you can still engage in that way. Something I thought was pretty interesting the other day was Alyssa Milano, who is not a politician, but she uses her platform she is very much an activist. And she met with Ted Cruz the other day, mm-hmm, and at the conclusion of that meeting was saying that he was a nice man. And this was after hurling.
Oh, man, she's going to get doxxed for that.
Yeah, right. But
yeah.
So hats off to her. As much as I disagree with so much of what she said, it was good for Ted Cruz and his campaign to reach out to her and her to actually agree to that. So I thought that was at least bit of encouragement.
We need more of that. But I mean, look, with the new NAFTA, the USMCA, that's, you know, already been signed off on, Canada's approved, Mexico's approved, mm-hmm, we should approve that. That helps us in our negotiations with China. I know I'm being a little redundant here, but we should give the president all the tools he can have. And look, I'm not a big fan of tariffs. I think the intellectual property should be a side issue, but I don't think you should be charging people tariffs, because I think ultimately it hurts consumers.
Yeah. Let's circle back just to finish up on the presidential campaign, because I'm very fascinated by Elizabeth Warren. She's getting these very big crowds, but she, at one point, you know, a few months back, she was like 1% in the polls, and she's just getting these huge crowds. And, you know, the last Massachusetts liberal, I'm old enough to remember when Michael Dukakis got the nomination. He had a huge lead going into that election. Of course, it blew up in his face. But just kind of interested in, see, I think she's very vulnerable, even though we don't see it yet. I mean, she's going to be vulnerable in the Rust Belt, just this sort of this Massachusetts liberal. I think she's going to be vulnerable in a lot of these swing states in a way that
in key states, she will be very vulnerable. And quite honestly, I was involved 41 in the race. When people found out what his record was on law enforcement and other things, he really tanked it. And I mean, he was endorsed by the ACLU.
Mm-hmm.
But today, it's a little different in the sense that you have a lot of millennials and college kids now. We know they don't vote as much.
Right.
But they've bought into a lot.
Sure.
They have bought into it. They confuse social justice with socialism, and that's a problem for the Republicans. I will say this, and I've thought about this a lot. Can't we make a generational change? Everybody we're running is over 70.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point.
What's going on with that?
Yeah, you have some younger people like O'Rourke and Yang, but they, you know, Yang's done okay, but O'Rourke now is just completely tanked.
Well, and Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard is in her 30s, but she tanked as well. She seems to have a more of a
career. Well, yeah, she's too right wing now for that.
You would think that the Democrats could produce somebody else that was more.
Mm-hmm.
The problem for any Democrat that gets involved in a race against the president, it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's not going to be Marcus Greenberg. When he's on stage with whoever it is, it's not going to be pretty. Mm-hmm. And he's more well-versed than he was before.
Yeah.
He's not the guy that we knew.
No, he's very good at what he does, just in sort of his stage persona. I mean, you saw that in the campaign where a lot of people made fun of it. But when you would kind of just tune into one of his rallies, and because he's an entertainer, that's his background. I mean, he understands entertainment, and the way that he plays off the crowd is better probably than any politician I've seen in a long time.
Well, the other thing is, he knows the issues.
Yeah, he does.
He knows the issues better. Look, there's a lot of people with this latest strike that happened on the Saudi Arabian oil field that wanted to go to war. One of them was John Bolton, no longer there. One of them was Lindsey Graham.
Mm-hmm.
He backed off. None of our people were killed. I don't think he's going to jump into war. And by the way, the American people, and I would argue millennials and everybody else, are just war. They're tired of war. And this was brought up last week on Front Row. There are people going to Afghanistan that weren't even born.
Oh, I know. Yep.
They're 18 now. And you're asking people to go there to fight a war. Look, I'm not for losing a war, but what is the mission?
Yeah.
And they really don't know what the mission is. Plus, you have a lot of Afghan soldiers who are on base with our folks who are embedded with the Taliban, and these guys, women are asleep at night, and they're murdered.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a problem, I think. And I think
my husband lost some of his people that way.
Excuse me for interrupting.
No,
and Walter Jones, I mean, I think, as long as this goes on, he's just getting proven more and more right. I think there has to be a defined mission. There has to be a defined exit strategy, and we don't have that.
In May of the first year of Iraq.
Right.
But I think it was unconscionable. Once we were there, though, I disagreed with Walter, because you cannot disagree with the commander in chief when the troops are there. And that's my personal point of view. But he was right in the sense that we never should have gotten it. By the way, so was Rand Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the American people are. If there's a defined mission, and two, it's in our national security interest. Right? Right now, I mean, it's unbelievable to me that they didn't have a better defense system in Saudi Arabia for their oil field.
Yeah.
Clearly they didn't. And it could happen again. I would say that there's a chance of war if one of our ships is attacked. We lose some sailors or soldiers. But beyond that, I don't think Trump's going in.
Mm-hmm. So let's pivot over to something a little bit more philosophical, not necessarily political, although it very much intersects. But what do you think the future of conservatism looks like going forward? A lot of people have made the case that under President Trump, the GOP looks a lot different.
Well, I do think it looks a lot different. One, it's not Reagan conservatism. I worked for Ronald Reagan. It's not Buckley, Burke conservatism, Reagan conservatism, Goldwater conservatism. I would say that Trump is more pragmatic. I don't think that Ronald Reagan would have ever put tariffs on China.
Yeah, no, I don't
think.
And
also, but it's a different era where Trump comes personally. Ronald Reagan was probably one of the most gracious men. When he walked into a room, you kind of feel it. Even if there was Twitter at that time, I don't think. Candidly, he never would have attacked a woman. He just never would have done it. He wasn't brought up that way.
Right.
But he came up in an era, what we were talking about earlier, where he could work with the Tip O'Neill. He could work with the Democrats. I mean, remember, he got the tax cut through his first year.
Mm-hmm.
His first year, and that was Jack Kemp, who was a mentor of mine. But I think the direction of conservatism, when you look, a lot of people like talk about conservatism, but don't know the tenets of free market conservatism. They don't know. They'd like to be tagged with that. I'm a conservative, but I'm not sure they know about Burke. I'm not sure they know about Milton Friedman. And I don't think they've studied it. I don't think very many politicians do that anymore. I think they're more interested if their hair looks good. They get their talking points from their staff. And if you look, I used to talk to Newt. I said, Newt, when you will go down to
Newt Gingrich.
And I say, Newt, when you go down to the floor, do you pre-program that? They used to do those things in Congress when there was nobody there, but it looked like they didn't have these debates over education or whatever it was. He said, no, I just walked down with Bob Walker, whoever it was. And we just decide right then and there what we're going to talk about. But they were very well versed. They were student of politics. Today, a lot of these guys that are in Congress, they can't operate without the talking points. They're all staffed up. And frankly, to be candid with you, the staff knows more than the congresswoman or the senator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just the way it is. And I think it's kind of a laziness. But a lot of them are more interested in getting on TV than they really. And then they get in that combative mode. I mean, I understand you got to defend Donald Trump. And I think things really went haywire on this whole FBI Russia collusion. On the other hand, I think the American people are sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I think, I think that that's a winning issue now for Trump, and he'll continue to win on that. I guess one thing I have on, you know, we talk about the future of conservatism and Reagan, obviously, versus Trump or just other, you know, anybody who knows the Republican Party, it wasn't a conservative party for a long time. I mean, you had Nixon and Ford who weren't particularly conservative, at least in the mold of Reagan, and even going back before that. I mean, people like Robert Taft and Goldwater were anomalies. But I guess the thing is that sometimes frustrates me with, you know, I'd be a little bit different conservative than Trump, obviously. But I get frustrated sometimes when people say, well, you know, it's just so much better under Paul Ryan or some of these people that failed. And sometimes I think we compare these sort of live alternatives with this theoretical conservative. In many ways, Washington failed and created Trump. And so I think that's a big frustration for a lot of, you know what I mean? It's just a frustration when Paul Ryan got steamrolled by Obama over and over and over again.
Ray, you're absolutely right. And by the way, a lot of people couldn't see it coming.
Yeah.
They couldn't see it because there was a revolt. And he was almost like a Tea Party candidate. But I wouldn't classify Donald Trump as a conservative.
Right.
I would classify him as a pragmatist. Okay, Reagan was a conservative. You're right about Nixon at times was a conservative, but he grew the government.
Right, sure.
He have the education department, health.
So he was very Keynesian in his economics.
Yeah, right. And he's the one that got rid of the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Reagan was a direct reaction from Goldwater. Okay. And when he made that speech, A Time for Choosing, that's what launched Ronald Reagan. But the thing about Reagan that's very different than Trump, okay? Trump doesn't have very many loyalists around him. He made some personalist policy. That's what Reagan used to say. And the people who were around Reagan had been with him a lot. Some of them, right? Some of them broke from 76.
Yeah, some of them from California.
Like Edward Meese, who became an attorney general counselor to the president, I would argue was the closest person alive right now, former president, except for maybe Michael Reagan. But they were loyal to him. The people who are with the president there now are to build their resume, and they want to go out and make a fortune out of it. They weren't, other than Ivanka and Jared, all right? I would say the most loyal person to the president right now is Kellyanne, and probably the most articulate. She's got the most coherent message in mind. But their whole shop is nothing near what Reagan's was. You have to remember, love or hate Jim Baker, he could have been president. He was pretty damn good.
Yeah, well, he even told Bush he could have been president one time.
Well,
he had Ed Meese. Michael Deaver was a big part of that White House.
He understood pictures and how to put things on television. He was probably the best advanced man in the 20th century. And you had George Shultz, one of the most underrated secretaries of state. So you had Cap Weinberger. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look around, a lot of those guys were capable of being president.
Right.
When you look around and you look at, this is not to disrespect Trump, and I think Pence is a great guy, but his cabinet's pretty weak comparatively to, I'd say Carson's very smart, all right?
Yeah.
But it's different. I mean, the people who were around the president, and they believed in Reagan.
Sure.
Okay. I'm not sure all the people in the White House believe in Donald Trump. I think they believe in him.
No, I think that's a fair criticism. He's certainly not attracted some of the best and brightest from across the country. And you're right. He doesn't have, you know, being a chief executive like Reagan. Reagan was able to pull from, you know, the party was much more, at least institutionally united. It's not, it may be united under Trump, but it's not institutionally united sort of in the Beltway. So, you know, Reagan was able to draw from Washington and California.
I was in the transition. Okay? Mm-hmm. We had most of our secretaries of the department confirmed within the first 2 weeks.
Right.
And a deputy. Okay. Within a month, there was, because Reagan had worked it. They had worked right after the election with the Democrats to get these guys through, or women, okay? And so he came in with a team that was already in place.
Right.
And these people had a code. Let me tell you, there's one person that you really didn't want to cross, and that was Nancy Reagan. If you embarrassed Ronald Reagan, you were history. Period. End of story. Even if there was a hint of scandal. I'm not even talking
about
you were in the administration.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you were coming into the White House and they did a background check on you,
mm-hmm.
if you had a hint of scandal, you weren't allowed in. I mean, it was just a different time.
Yeah.
She was very protective of him. But you're not, I mean, I'd argue that Reagan was probably the most significant person in the last half of the president, last half of the 20th century, and probably more significant than FDR. Because if you look at FDR, the only thing that got us out of the Depression was the war. His policies actually,
they were
in the Depression, they got out, then they got back into a recession. His policies of the New Deal really didn't work.
Yeah, The Forgotten Man by Amity Slaves is a really good book on that, of course. And then you mentioned Nancy Reagan. It was, of course, her that ultimately sunk, was it Don Regan?
Let me tell you, I had something. There was a place called Wexford up in Middleburg.
Mm-hmm.
Reagan moved his headquarters from L.A. to Arlington the last 6 months of the campaign. So they lived in Middleburg, which was Jackie Kennedy's old horse farm, which she bought for $30,000. Reagan was up there. Reagan never went into headquarters.
Uh-huh.
So I was up there. I was attached to Meese. I was attached to then who became attorney, Edwin Meese, who became attorney general. So I was up there. And all the guys would come out to Greenspan, Baker, mm-hmm. Jack Kemp, all these guys. They would come out there and they'd sit and plow around it. And I was just, you know, a little cog in the machine. But she'd make me peanut butter sandwiches.
Right.
She'd say, would you take a note to Cap Wamberg? What am I saying? Would you get the laundry? Well, yeah, I get it. Because, you know, you're in a campaign, you do what you have to do. But I found her to be very nice. I think it really shook her when he was shot. And she got a lot more productive then. But think about that. That guy was 69 years old, and it was literally.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah.
His heart. And I think it slowed him down some. I'd never have bought in that he had all.
No. I don't believe that.
Towards the end of his tenure. But he was very confident, but he wasn't arrogant.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly just going back for early in life in terms of some of the influences that he had. He was a very magnanimous person. People talked about him being very private too in many ways. And sometimes people who were their father was an alcoholic are like that too. He didn't have a lot of close friends, but he drew a lot of people to him.
About the alcoholism, he told me one time, Mark, I know everything I put in.
Yeah.
And see, I've got a picture of him in the White House, not to brag, but after their traffic control strike, we were over there celebrating because I was over at DOT. I was in congressional relations. And so he has a glass of champagne in his hand. But he always sip it. He never drank because his father was. He used to pull his father out of bars.
Right.
But you think about it. I mean, he was a lifeguard, football player, sports announcer, Hollywood movie star, governor, president. That's pretty good.
Yeah, indeed it is. He has quite the legacy, and I just enjoy even hearing you talk about your own experiences with him and that insider perspective. We have to get close to wrapping it up now, but I did have another question for you. Can you make some predictions, which I know they're educated ones, you read all the time, and you have a lot of experience on this front. What do you foresee being the top three policy issues that really drive the presidential campaign once the Democratic candidate is selected?
Well, it'll be the economy, it'll be immigration, and it'll be national defense. Now, a subset of that will be that evangelicals on the pro-life issue are fully behind the president. And so I think those would be the top four. And I would say that would be hard to argue with. And you could argue that it's Morning in America. Here in North Carolina, I know that the presumptive favorite for governor is Cooper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I would not discount the Danforth.
Yeah, he's a vote getter. He's a vote getter.
The reason why I'd say that is because the way the General Assembly has set him up with all these issues, whether it's born alive, whether it's the tax bill, whether it's the sheriff's cooperating with ICE, he's got a lot of issue sets to work with, and he's got a solid base. So I think it's going to be interesting, and I'm actually trying to interview right now, get an interview with Elizabeth Warren. I think I have an interview with Vice President Pence, but everybody's going to be, because we are a purple state. It's hard to believe.
Yeah, it'll be.
But it's just an influx of people.
Read something, or I wrote something on Civitas about this, but I think I saw it somewhere first. Florida, North Carolina has been closer, I think, than Florida and Ohio in the last several elections.
Now, you know what? Florida's off the table.
Yeah, I mean, Florida's trending right. Yeah. In Ohio,
right,
too.
Right. They've taken that, but they're worried about North Carolina's in play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mark, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Been good. I've loved hearing your stories and your analysis. It's been good. So
yeah, excellent.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Mark.
If you have any questions and you want to send them into us for the podcast recording, we can make sure to get them to Mark. So just email us at radio@nccivitas.org.
Or you can reach me at Front Row Mark on Twitter.
Okay, that's perfect as well. And then what times can they find in channels?
Friday night we'll be on 8:30 on UNC TV, PBS North Carolina channel at 9 o'clock, 4 o'clock on the North Carolina channel on Saturday, Sunday at 9:30 on the North Carolina channel, and 12 noon.
Wow.
That was pretty good.
All the times, all weekend, just keep it on UNC TV.
I don't think
UNC
I could do that.
Okay, so thank you all for joining us, and have a wonderful week.